Everyone's asleep. Everyone but me. And I can't help feel like I'm doing this all by myself.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting live from the fabulously fluoridated capital of Auckland, New Zealand, the island chains nation in the sunny slave South Pacific. It's not only gorgeous, it's also Fukushima irradiated, which is good for the economy, because now everybody got a part-time job as an incandescent light bulb. It's the lighter side of genocide, because in a world so full of chaos and madness and, disasters of every single make and model you could possibly conceive of. If you lose your sense of humour, you'll go friggin' nuts. No fear, ladies and gentlemen. Only a few cackles. My very special guest is the lovely Alex Robinson. Alex, welcome to the programme.
Thank you.
I believe you're coming to us from Auckland as well.
That's right.
All right. Well, why don't you give us a bit of a background about yourself and who you are and what it is you do?
I have a blog called Too Long in This Place, and I've been writing since 2008, and it's kind of hard to explain what I do. I do it's a mixture of things, using intuition, synchronicity, questioning things. I mean, I think everyone who comes here at some point realizes that things just don't feel right in the world, and we all find our way here. And I just got to a sort of a time and a place where I just needed to say it out loud, you know, speak it out loud, to ask questions.
Okay, and what kind of set you off on this wee journey here?
There was quite a few things, but I guess I put it back to seeing the Anzac War Memorial statue in Sydney back in about 2007. And at the time, I was reading a book by Matthew Deleuze. I don't know if you've heard about him.
But no.
The reading and sort of what I was seeing around Sydney, the symbolism, you know, things like that. But it was seeing this statue that really shocked me, and the whole, my son and I happened to be there at the time when it was 11 o'clock and they do the, you have to stand still for 2 minutes and, you know, sort of give honour to all these, all the dead. And the symbolism and the, it's kind of hard to explain the effect that had on me, but the sacrifice, the statue, is really quite shocking. And I've done a lot of work looking into Anzac, the history of the Anzacs, a lot of looking into New Zealand, and just so much doesn't make sense and so much doesn't add up. And I just keep looking and keep asking questions.
So specifically an Anzac memorial that woke you up and kind of just made you sort of jump out of jump out of your seat or your skin, as it were, just go, you know what, something's really, really wrong. I have to do something.
Yeah, very basically, yes. Yep.
Mm-hmm. And I've always felt that way about the Anzac things as well. Like Anzac Day, we celebrate it every year, and I see these politicians who are mired in corruption scandals and things of that nature laying wreaths and saying we must honour the dead and their sacrifice while we corruptly take over the country. And it infuriates me.
Oh, it's a massive sham. And the whole Anzac thing is a concocted thing between, you know, Australia and New Zealand. I mean, there's all this thing about Gallipoli. And it's as if there was only New Zealanders and Australians at Gallipoli. When in actual fact, like my great-granduncle was there. He was Irish. We never hear about that. So it's like we took possession of this. You know, this is our thing. And we built, I think it's because Australia and New Zealand don't have a long history. So we built up this kind of sham, amazing, you know, look what we did, look who we are.
It's kind of like somebody who doesn't really have a life pointing to the one time that they actually did and say that this is what I am.
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of how we've been shaped. And the sham of, when, you know, Anzac Day is coming upon us, and at the end of the day, what's war? It's just massive slaughter. And when I looked into the Anzacs, there's this very strange thing where they took them and they went to the Middle East, and they set up the camp, the Anzac camp, directly beneath the pyramids. Now, it's just really, really bizarre. Why would you do that? It's very, very strange. So kind of looking at the symbolism of what was all that about, why would you, and just feeling like the whole, you know, Anzac thing has so much to do with sacrifice, like symbolic sacrifice and, you know, so forth, things like that.
Yeah, that was what I was going to say. You know, why would they camp out all underneath the pyramids and stuff? Maybe some kind of Illuminati blood sacrifice ritual or something?
Yeah. I mean, I don't really use the word Illuminati, but yes, that's sort of, there's a lot of stuff. There's so much that we don't understand, and there's so much that so many people aren't willing to look at or just question and go, hey, this is really weird. I don't know what the answer is, but isn't this kind of really weird?
Yeah, the whole system doesn't really make sense to me, and I think that was what I was like, what I was like as a young man, and why I got into trouble so much. I think I got suspended like 17 times from school, Alex. You know, and that was just one of the schools that I went to. I've got expelled from a number. It's because nothing made sense to me, and when I tried to ask them, you know, what the heck is going on here, I'd be treated as being insubordinate and be expelled or suspended again. And well, that's not entirely dissimilar to what happens in general society as well. You know, you got an employer or you're in the political game or something like that. As soon as you start questioning and demanding answers and things like that, you're a bad person.
Where I'm getting to, I'm trying to understand why does that happen, you know? Why is it that you want to ask questions and you cannot make the connection with the other person? They cannot hear you. And I get this feeling that there is no framework there for them to understand. They're living in a particular structure, and this is how it is. Now, some of us say, I'm not happy. This structure doesn't work for me. It doesn't feel right. I want to look a different way. But the people who are within the structure will do everything to protect that structure, and they cannot see or contemplate or even want any other kind of structure. So we're trying to create a framework of something new. And it's very, very difficult, hard work, and you get squashed and stood on and people knock you all the time. But it's this delicacy of trying to create a framework where there actually is nothing before. So we're going from nothing and trying to build something. And at the same time, there are people who keep trying to crush it, break it down. And you just have to bend yourself in all different kind of weird shapes to try and get across to people. A lot of the time now, I haven't bothered. I will just work towards the people who want to build a different framework as well. What is the point of trying to reach to people who Their ears are so close, their mind is so close, and they will fight you to protect the system and the structure that they are within.
They don't understand that waking up isn't something that's quite so ethereal and what have you. The analogy of the Matrix, as we're kind of alluding to here, is very, very real. When you wake up and you suddenly realize the whole world is against you, and there's all this scumbaggery and symbolism and this kind of stuff, and it's just not real anymore, that life that you thought that you had. It reminds me of what Neo did when he found out about the truth. He said, "No, no, I don't believe it." And then he passed out and vomited on the floor.
It's hard work. It's really hard work, and you don't know where you're going, and no one has any answers. No one has any answers. You know, they might say that they do, but they don't. And as soon as you think you have an answer, the route changes and you're somewhere else. So it's a constant. What I really like to use is Edward de Bono, the guy who did lateral thinking. He talks about proto-truths. So a proto-truth, which is a name he made up, is the truth that is the most real at the moment. It works the best at the moment. But at any point, it can be changed, added to, got rid of, and something new brought in. So we have this kind of flexible, living, working kind of truth. There isn't this one, the truth. So I like to work with that and use synchronicity, intuition, research, whatever, to follow along that, explore it. So much to me is about if we could just explore things. Look, how does this look for you? What does this feel like for you? This is what happens so much with people who are stuck within the structure, is that they're not willing to look, so they won't give us any feedback. They won't explore it.
Well, if this lack of exploration is the very reason why everybody's basically burrowed themselves into this sort of backward corner and just going, no, no, nothing else exists except for the things that I want to exist. It's no wonder society's going like to hell in a handbasket, being controlled by people who are manipulative. You know, that's what I've determined, is that, you know, you have a look at the symptoms of what a psychopath is. The American Medical Journal stated that these people are really smiley, friendly, kind of intoxicating people when you first meet them. But there's no real depth to their personality. They don't have a whole lot of long-lasting relationships outside of some pretext of business or something like that. And the three most likely industries you are to find these people is business, politics, and media. And I was just thinking to myself, holy cow! That describes almost perfectly every employer that I've had my entire life and every politician that I've ever seen ruling my country for my entire life as well. So we're under the control of a psychopathic system, right? These psychopaths might not be aware of the plan, overall plan, but they're all certainly playing their part.
To my mind, where I've got to now is to see that the West is a trauma-based society. Everything about the West, and right from the word go, is trauma. So right from even, you know, the birthing processes, through schooling, everything from every angle is creates trauma. And trauma of itself is not bad. I mean, we don't want trauma. Trauma's not nice. But the toxicity and the poison that comes with trauma is when you're not allowed to heal. And that's where I see the problem is. The human body can handle so much in terms of the foods we eat or the stresses we're under. But we need to be able to release, heal from, come back to balance. And I think that's where I see the problem is. We're not allowed to come back to balance. What happens is that you have trauma on top of trauma on top of trauma, and never can you come back to balance. And for me, this balance, so much of it comes when you're allowed to speak and explore and talk things out. So much healing comes from just being allowed to talk things out. Say, this is how it feels for me. You know, how does it feel for you? This doesn't seem right. This doesn't look right. Doesn't this seem strange to you? You know, but there is this lid, and God forbid that anyone should ever express emotion, be unhappy, yet not have this smile on their face, not kowtow to these idiots who are in charge all over the place. They are psychopathic, you know? And I think if our senses worked well, I know a previous boss of mine, I felt like if my senses worked well, I would see this decomposing corpse in front of me.
With the evacuated bowels and everything. Hey, that was the other thing that occurred to me while you were saying that is, you know, heaven forbid somebody show a real emotion or have or actually be, you know, crying or something like that and be in real need of some emotional cajoling, as it were. And I was just thinking about this phenomenon. Has anybody ever asked you, you know, how are you? And they actually don't give a frack how you are. it's a proto hello. You know, instead of saying hello, how are you? It's just saying how are you, as opposed to hello, and they don't really care about the response. I remember one time I tried to what was I doing? I was walking along the street trying to say hello to everybody as they went past. It was just to do a bit of an experiment. As one guy rocked past me, he went, "Get him, mate." He said, "Good day, mate," but he did it so fast in an effort to get away from somebody who was actually having some social interaction that he didn't even know. They say, "Get him out," and then they keep walking.
Yep.
And I think that's what's going on here, really, is that people don't give a frack about how each other is. And as a direct result, people feel neglected and mental illness and indeed stress itself bubbles away. And people will just get worse and worse and worse and retreat inwards because they feel like nobody cares about them. And for the most part, they're correct.
That's right. Again, we're not allowed emotion. I've just written an article, actually, about the importance of dislike and that we're not allowed to dislike things. You know, we're supposed to you've got to put a smile on your face all the time, you know. And I had someone have a go at me a few weeks ago at the beach because I was obviously glowering. I was thinking deeply and, you know, I spent so long afterwards. I just walked the entire beach swearing my head off, you know, like, how dare you? If my face isn't happy and smiling, what is that to do with you? And a little while ago, I went out for a walk and thought, I'm going to practice dislike. What do I dislike? And at the end of it, I found, hey, I really don't like fences. You know, I don't like fences. I never even knew that. And I know that sounds really silly, but what I got to thinking was, if I didn't know that I don't like fences, they really bug me, how many other things are there in my life that I don't know that I dislike? Therefore, I'm just accepting them. I'm letting them be in my life. And again, it seems to me it's this shutdown of emotions. I think in childhood, we're shut down. You have to like. There's so many things you have to be forced. You have to force yourself to like.
That's true. And one person once told me once when we were drunk at a party, "Vinny, is there anything you hate?" And I go, I don't know. And they go, "What about gangs?" And I go, whoa, hold on a second. You just reminded me. Yes, I freaking hate the gangs, especially the one in blue uniforms. We'll be right back after the break.
The word is about, there's something evolving. Whatever may come, the world keeps revolving. They say the next big thing is here, that the revolution's near. But to me it seems quite clear that it's all just a little bit of history repeating.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome back to the Vinny Eastwood Show. My very special guest is with me, Alex Robinson from TooLongInThisPlace.wordpress.com. That's TooLongInThisPlace. That's one word, which is several words, but there's all strung together. .wordpress.com. Alex, welcome back.
Thank you.
Now, in terms of the education system, and I wanted to get into this a little bit. I mean, I'm just explained a little bit about my school history, of course, rather sordid. I was wondering how you actually survived going through school, or unless, of course, you were homeschooled or something.
No, it was certainly not the best years of your life. You know, I don't know who made that up, but I was the opposite to you. I was very, 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 very good. Very good. And, I think I'm doing my teenage rebellion now. But It was really hard on me, but everything about my childhood was hard, both home and school. There was no break for me. And in fact, I ended up leaving school, going straight into Auckland Hospital as an anorexic. So, and definitely part of that is the whole schooling system. It's inhuman. There is a brilliant book written by an American who was a teacher. And when I read it, things I'd never even thought about, just the inhumanity of, like, you put everyone together who's just in the same year. And maybe you might have had really good friends above or below you, but you never mix. You always stay with these same group of people just because they're the same age. You know, and in society, in a healthy society, the older ones look after the younger ones, but you don't have any of that. And this whole, like, having hour-long segments, and no matter what you're doing, the bell goes, you have to stop. There's so many things that break the natural human, the nature of how we are, how we're meant to be. Schooling just, it just cracks and breaks it from every angle. I find it so inhuman. When my son was about 11 or 12, and he was saying that he didn't like it, and I was about to go into the spiel, well, you know, you just got to, you know, you've got to get through. And then I just realized, no, you're right. You're right. School is shit. I mean, school is awful. And from then on, we never lied about it. And I said, look, you know, you get a day off every term, your choice, whenever you want. So we always had that little bit to fall back on as he got older, you know, 2 days off, you know, and I would make excuses for him. I saw the inhumanity of the whole system. It's so inhuman, but you're not allowed to say it. God forbid that you should speak out about it.
You know, it would be interesting to see an angry parent get up and speak at a school assembly and tell the entire school how crap the entire school really is and how it's merely a trauma-based mind control program in order to indoctrinate them into being the next generation of slaves.
You see, that there is no framework there for them to hear that. There is nothing within them that allows that information to pass through into their conscious awareness. They are fully protecting the system. They believe in it. They sold themselves. They gave themselves to it. And now they are its loyal soldiers, you know.
Well, this is indeed the problem, and also the reason why I came up with the idea that we needed a new school system, and not one that replaces the current one, but one that runs along parallel. Like, if you don't want the public idea of the school system or whatever, you can go into this new school system, which will teach you about real history, real health, about metaphysics and synchronicity and all of these good things that we've learned basically as part of the truth movement, which can be, admittedly, an extremely rude and traumatic awakening, simply to know just a few of the very things that are going on in this world. And the other element of this is, would parents even take that opportunity, or would they be so blinded by government propaganda that they would prefer their children to come home every day bored and miserable, complaining about how much school sucks, as opposed to coming home excited, happy, that they learned something new and amazing today?
Well, see, you sort of bring up a point, which is where my work is going, and again, it's very hard to talk about, but as far as I can see, the world is run by parents, because what the parents shape their children, they affect their children in so many ways, and parents are the result of parents who are the result of trauma. You have these trauma generations of traumatized parents who put the trauma on the new generation, and that is why you won't get the parents to hear you. You know, you're not looking at healthy individuals. You are looking at people who are so indebted to the system, who are so loyal to the system, and they will pass it down to their children, and they will. This work that we do is so massive. It's so complex. It's about the future. It is about giving children real life, giving them the opportunity to... It's about not crushing them. It's not that we actually need to do much for children. They're fine as they are. It's what we need to not do to them. to crush their spirits, to force them into all so much inhumanity. You know, the cruelty to children is extreme, and it's so much of it is you can't see it. It looks as if, oh, this is for the best thing for my children, you know? These days, how many children are, like, pushed into how many things they have to do after school when, you know, really, for the health, they should be at home just, you know, playing with their friends, mucking about with their friends, but no, they've got to go to all these organized events, they've got to learn this. And why is that? How much of that is about how it makes the parents look good?
Yeah. I know the type you're talking about. My son goes to this and that after school activity. My son has awards. My son has trophies. My son has this, that, and the other. Did you know your son is also addicted to pot and freaking hates you?
Yeah.
because of the traumatic stuff that you've made him go through, you know?
That's right. I mean, and so much, it's this, one of the biggest things that I've seen is to understand we live in a world where parents own their children. That is the concept. We, 100%. You know, the other day I was just walking, there was this guy just being so horrible to his son, you know? And I turned around, I did my best to turn around and say, look, I can see what you're doing. And he just like, yeah, what are you looking at, you know? And there was nothing I could do. Because he owns his child. He can do whatever he wants. This idea of child ownership just goes back, it's eons old. As if there is something or so many things that need to be done to children. In actual fact, they are fine. We're the ones who need to be learning from the children. We're the ones who are so mucked up in our heads, not the children.
It's the children that need to be left alone and the adults who need to grow up, in other words.
It's the adults who need to learn from the children. There is a wonderful book by a guy called Ashley Montague, and it's called Growing Young. And it's based on a, I don't know if it's a science, it's a whatever, it's called neoteny, which says that in a species that doesn't change its shape much from when it's a baby, so humans, we don't change much from when we are babies, you know, we grow higher, we get a bit hairier, but we're not much different. Whereas other animals, they change quite distinctly from their baby stage to their adult stage, like chimpanzees, you know, their faces become elongated. They change a lot. So he was saying their belief is that if you don't change much, if your species doesn't change much, then they're meant to keep the characteristics of the young. So the characteristics of the young in humanity are curiosity, play, spontaneity, exploration, all these things. But what happens? Where does all that go to? So according to neoteny, we are meant to keep those characteristics. That's what we need for our species to evolve, to grow, to continue.
Yeah, whereas the problem is they've replaced neoteny with monotony.
Yeah, well, it's called gerontology, where you go towards the older, you know. But yeah, we're meant to keep all these young traits. And
you're pretty lucky if you manage to keep on to them.
Oh, you know, at one point I was researching play, and basically, if you look on the internet, up to 12 years of age, children can play. After that, you type in the word play on the internet, adult play, and you just sex toys. Adult play is about sex toys. It's about, So what happened to play for adults? Now, God, I would love to see an adult's playground. We need them so bad. You know, we need this ability to play. We've become so rigid.
Yeah, and we're not talking about like an adult playground as in like a monkey bars with dildos or something like that. We're talking about something. Here's the other thing, speaking of climbing frames, how exactly does an adult have fun these days? And what you're talking there about, exploration, creativity, I think adults are more closer to building things, creating things, making works of art and things of that nature. Like the things that kids do when they're building with, say, their Lego or their Duplo, or they're doing finger painting or things of that nature, there's actual adult versions of them where an adult can actually make a real masterpiece painting. A child's not capable of creating something with that that complexity or that... or that high standard of workmanship as a child does, but an adult can do that. And does that count as play? Is that really what we're talking about here? Simply taking the same things that children are currently doing, but just adultifying them so that there's an element of extra quality or something like that to it. Is that what we're talking about here?
I've actually started up a site with a Kiwi friend of mine, which is about trying to encourage people to get back to play, to creating. See, we've got this idea that creativity is special and that there are creative people out there, and then there's the rest of us plebs who are just, well, we go and appreciate people who are really good. We can't do it. And that's just so much rubbish, you know. And again, through the media has told us there are great artists, there are great writers, there are great blah, 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 blah. And we never can compete with them, so just give up now. And so many people are terrified to even pick up like a paintbrush, or they're terrified to even try and do something. And yet this is, if Neoteny is correct, this is our nature, to pick up a paintbrush or pick up a pencil and just go for it. And everything really comes down to practice, you know? If you pick up a paintbrush and the first thing you do is, well, it's going to be pretty crap. But that's just normal. You just keep practicing. You just play. You get better. You learn things. So what I've started doing is using Paint, and you know, on the computer and the accessories. It's a really, really basic program, and it's so much fun. And I just keep getting better. And I'm trying to encourage other people to do the same thing. Anything they want, photography, whatever. Send it into the site. We put it up there, and it's just. People are terrified. There's actually like a phobia against creating. We have a phobia.
I think it's the fear of rejection. You know, oh, that photo you took isn't very good, you know, from other adults and stuff like that. We hate that.
Oh, we're terrified of it because we're terrified of looking stupid. This is looking stupid, looking foolish is one of the biggest control mechanisms within the West.
See, I love looking foolish. I mean, just look at my hair.
I believe the fool in tarot is the beginner. The fool is the one who starts anything. The fool is the pioneer. Whenever you start something, you're going to be messy. You're going to be, it's not going to look good. You're going to fall over. You're going to look silly. That is the most sacred place in humanity because that's the birth process. That is the starting of something.
That's what humbles you, you know, for tripping over and falling. And you go, you know, maybe I'm not as sure-footed as a mountain goat as I thought.
Yeah, but children don't even have that. They don't even need to feel humble. When they fall over, all they know is they want to walk. So back they up again. You know, there is nothing. They don't feel foolish. They just, damn, do it again, do it again, do it again. They never give up.
Maybe as adults we reflect back quite constantly on the times that we've messed up and feel ashamed of it. I get that a lot. Do you?
Explain.
Well, let's say you've done something in your life that was really stupid. Like you said something stupid to somebody, and they suddenly go out of whack or out of control, and they mess up your life as a result of it. And you know, you get better and everything, and that kind of part of your life goes back. But every now and again, you'll think of that person, and just go, "Oh God, I was so stupid. Why did I say that?" Like what's his name? Rob Tappert. He's the producer of like The Grudge, The Grudge 2, and a whole bunch of other horror movies like The Evil Dead. Is married my cousin Lucy Lawless, and I tried to pitch to him like a book of my friend that I hadn't even read, you know, that he was trying to make into a film, and I just totally ballsed it up. And it's like every now and again I'll think back to that moment and just go, frack, I was such a young idiot.
But those things that we do that about are actually massively important. Because they teach us so much. That's a little bit along the lines of the ability to know what we dislike. We need to muck up because we go, oh, that feels really bad. I don't want to go down that track. Now, I really know I don't want to go down that track again. It teaches you.
Well, it's fair enough. I'm just wondering why I keep looking back at these lessons that I've supposedly already learned and keep feeling bad about it. It's weird. We'll be right back after the break. Alex Robinson is my guest, ladies and gentlemen, at thevinnieeastwoodshow.com.
Ladies and gentlemen, do me a favor, smash the television and burn the newspaper. That shit will never tell you that the president's a traitor. Believe what you want, but my evidence is greater. What you know about the Bilderberg and New World Order? What you know about the real fluoride in your water? What you know about the bleeding uranium in the mortar? What you know about AIPAC controlling the reporter? What's
Welcome
wrong
back.
With the world? People kill people that other people can...
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. It's my final segment with the lovely Alex Robinson from Too Long in This Place.wordpress.com. So we've kind of coming full circle here. We started off talking about Anzacs and the military and the psychopaths in control and how much school freaking sucks and how much adults need to start playing a bit more. And it occurred to me over the break, if you're playing an instrument in a band, that's kind of like an adult form of play, isn't it? With other big kids around you? The creative process?
As long as you're enjoying it. As long as you're enjoying it, you know?
Hmm.
That's the thing. What you get fun out of, what makes you feel alive?
Yeah, it's pretty straightforward and fundamental like that, isn't it? Does it feel good for you? Well, yes, it does. Well, then it is good for you. Unless, of course, it's something like artificial sweetener.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, well, and I'm sure there's a lot of practices out there that are basically like the artificial sweeteners of the mind, you know, like watching television or movies endlessly or video games. You know, I play a bit of video games myself, and it occurred to me last time I played it, I was just like, man, I just spent like a whole hour doing this, and I've got absolutely nothing to show for it apart from an hour that just got wasted.
Yeah. It's like that. It's like with so many things, whether it's the TV will just take up your so much time. But I have a theory. I've done a reasonable bit of work about looking into the dark, into the nighttime, and how much how important that is for us. And like I daily go out for walks at night in the dark. It's a completely different atmosphere. It's a different feel. There's almost nobody on the streets. Everyone's inside. There's the lights flashing in the house. So people go to work. They get exhausted from a long day of doing something ridiculous and just wasting their time. Come home. They're so tired. Sit in front of the TV all night. But I believe that there's a very healing power in the nighttime, in the darkness, that we're missing out on. And that's part of what the TV is about. It's just keeping you away. When you go outside, the light, you know, lights everywhere. I don't know if you've seen the new lights on the cars, which are so bright. You know, everywhere, there's no place for us to go and be in the dark. The darkness is where everything is born. Like winter is actually the beginning of the year, not spring. Anything that's going to be born, it's always in the dark first. And I wonder if this is another reason why we're not progressing, we're not evolving. We've lost our connection to the place that we need to be in, which is the darkness and the night.
Mm. There's many, many vampires out there who would agree with you.
Yeah, well, good for them. Well, they're probably having fun anyway.
Yeah, sleeping on the necks of various celebrities in deep underground Los Angelino clubs, no doubt. In terms of the night, and I completely agree with you on this one, because I find a lot of my best ideas come to me like in the wee small hours, you know, the witching hours or whatever, not necessarily when it's dark. But when I go outside, I notice something being here in the city is that I've been out in the country many, many times. You look up in the sky and it's like you're covered in a blanket of stars. And in the city... You know, there's a lot of them, but it's nothing like that. You know, you can't see the edge of the Milky Way galaxy like you can when you're out in the country. You're not completely bathed in this starlight. It's like there's a haze from all this light pollution, and it makes me feel almost under pressure, if you know what I mean. As opposed to when you're out and there's no lights and you can see all the stars, kind of thing. I don't know why that is or why it makes me feel like that.
I think it's actually to do with light. I think light puts us under pressure. Like, you, in the daytime, when the sun's shining, everyone's busy, busy, busy doing things. It's almost like you've got to be doing something. Whereas the darkness is a very much about settling down, quieting down. And, I mean, you just see people out there in the... They can't stop during the day. And, again, you put your lights on at night, you can't stop. It just... I think it actually speeds up our physical, our bodies, our system. If you could probably watch on some kind of brain monitoring thing, you will probably see that there's things firing off all over the place when light is being, you know, when light is just too much light is entering our eyes. And I'm quite sure that our eyes have a great need for darkness as well. I mean, you know, if you've got a headache and you switch off the light, my God, how good does it feel? You know, it's just bliss.
I didn't know that.
Oh, it does. It's good.
I just thought headaches were just like a usually dehydration, so I just chug back some water and it's gone.
Okay, well, try the darkness. It's wonderful.
Try the darkness.
Yeah, go over to the dark side.
Yeah.
Look, it'll make you feel better.
Hey, so we've only got another 5 minutes left on here. My special guest, ladies and gentlemen, is Alex Robinson. Too long in this place. WordPress.com is her website. I was wondering if you have any particular words of wisdom, you know, as a mother, as a creative woman, and things of that nature. Do you have any real special candid advice that you'd like to give the listenership? I'll take that as a no.
Well, that's a...
I'm just joking.
Question.
Yeah.
But, hey, I thought I was going to hang around with Alan Green for the next hour.
Are you now? Okay.
Yeah.
In that case, maybe I've done a little something premature.
But I can go. It doesn't matter.
No. Stick around with Alan, because maybe I was just a little bit confused, because I think Guillaume, who's... By the way... in fact, I'll take this opportunity to thank Guillaume for getting all these wonderful guests this week. Thank you, bro. He's done a week for us before, ladies and gentlemen, one with Anthony Peake and a whole bunch of other really great guests within there. And he's organized this entire week of guests as well. For those of you who have been in the background of any radio programs, you know that organizing guests can be rather difficult, time-consuming, making sure everybody's in the same time zones and they've got their stuff worked out and what have you. He's done a really fabulous job. So I want to just take my hat off just quietly to him for, basically giving me a week of reprieve from organizing all the guests for myself. And this actually brings us to another point as well about collaboration. Because when you're in high school and things of that nature, I don't know about you, Alex, but I don't have any friends from high school anymore. Nor primary school, nor university, nor any employment opportunity that I've ever actually had before. Okay, I've got plenty of friends, none of them from those institutions that I was forced to work in. and I think there's a very good reason for that. It's because none of those people that I ever met or was, kind of friends with at the time had really any idea what the heck was going on and was actually really just believed in all of it, whereas, you know, I just kind of didn't, and I just didn't really want to be alone at those particular times. And it's great when you move out of that system and you start doing what is right. You get the right people starting to show up and work with you rather than working against you in your life. They're not wasting your time. They're actually saving you time. You know, they're not making your life something less meaningful. They're actually making it less meaningless, if you know what I mean. And this is something that I believe most people should be striving for, is attempting to be in contact with people that are inspiring, people that encourage you, and people that can help you, people who care about you, that kind of thing. That is really what's most important about this. Imagine if you were to fall into some bad trouble or something like that. You know, I had a bit of bad trouble on the show a couple of weeks ago, and I still haven't gotten through answering all the Skype messages and emails and Facebook messages and stuff that have all been coming at me, you know, pouring out of support, because there's just so much of it out there because I'm doing the right thing, you know, trying to help people get some freaking coverage. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I must admit, I think you must be, I don't know how you do what you do, because you must not be able to rest very much. to meet so many different people to try and, you know, get across, allow people a platform. And I think that's one of the things that we have to do, actually, is where we find that there's no platform for us to speak. There's no platform to do what we need to do. And what happens is we have to create it. So it didn't exist. You know, when I'm talking about creating, people think creating, oh, that's about going and doing some painting or something. It is not. It is about bringing into being something that doesn't exist because you really, really want it to exist. So in this instance, you've got this show, I've got my blog, other people have got things that they didn't exist. They made them exist. This is the creative process at its heart.
I've had a lot of people tell me they don't know how I do what I do. And I think they just don't understand how much of a lazy person I actually really am. I mean, basically, if you want to get a lot done, but you can't be bothered, try and figure out a really, really, really easy way. And in fact, this is something that one of our guests said yesterday. Tesla versus, who was the other guy? Edison. Edison says it's 99% perspiration, 1% inspiration. So he'll experiment 100 times or whatever before he gets something right. Tesla says it's 99% inspiration, 1% perspiration. If you sit there and really, really think and mull over what you want and how to create it and what you want to do, as soon as you implement it, you build it right first time and you don't have to repeat yourself 100 times over. That's kind of the methodology that I think we should all be following a little more closely so that we don't waste our time in the repetition, mind control, and scumbaggery. My very special guest is Alex Robinson. She'll be joining us over the break with my other very special friend, Ellen Abadesa-Green from The Sync Book. Ladies and gentlemen, we're going to be talking about synchronicity and a whole bunch of very interesting, inspirational, fabulous Shiite Muslim. It's going to be somewhat fabulous. Mantastic. And whatnot, various other nice adjectives too. Back in a minute. Gentlemen, to hour number two of the fastest 2 hours in talk radio. It's the Vinnie Eastwood Show, the lighter side of genocide, because in a world so full of chaos and madness and copious quantities of scumbaggery, if you lose your sense of humour, you'll go freaking nuts. Suspicion. Intrigue. And deception. Create dissension within the ranks. And I've seen this many, many times over my very short career in the truth movement, that many, many people will be utterly suspicious of other people within the truth movement, yet they don't have corresponding evidence. There'll be things like coincidences, like they'll see somebody standing next to the number 33 or something like that, and then say, well, obviously this person is a member of the Illuminati because in one particular picture they just happened to be standing next to a 33. Supplementary evidence, people! It's a good way of reducing speculation and actually knowing what the frack you're in fact talking about. And also, understanding that you don't know everything and that mere suspicion is not evidence of culpability. And it happens all throughout this movement, and people need to stop it. Okay? I have listeners who listen to this show who also listen to other people's shows who are like, you know, done bad things to me or whatever. And they say, you know, I'm still listening to that person because they've got, like you, some good information. And I say that's a very, very healthy attitude. Don't let other people's enemies become your enemies just because they've done something bad to somebody else. Doesn't mean that they're a bad person at all. Might be a little bit of a scuffle, like a lover's quarrel, if it were. My very special guest is Alan Abadesa Green, and we are still with Alex Robinson as well. So, Alan, welcome back to another exciting show. Alan, can you hear me?
Happy to be with you again. And Alex, always a pleasure to speak to you. Yeah, I can hear you. Are you not hearing me at all?
Oh, yeah. Your video was just kind of frozen a bit, and now it's like really badly out of sync. You might want to quickly turn it off and then switch it back on. That'll probably resolve the issues there. But in either case, the website that we have for you, is it still the syncbook.com, is it?
Correct, yes, thesyncbook.com.
Okay.
And just a nice reminder is that it's S-Y-N-C.
Yeah, absolutely. There is another syncbook.com, but I believe it's Titanic-related. maritime history website. Yeah, maritime. It's a maritime website. Of course. Naturally.
So I was listening to, think about the second half hour of the first hour. Really enjoying listening to you two speak. And I don't know, you guys sort of hit on some really interesting territories. I don't know if you want to kind of run with it. But basically, there's things like this idea of a voyage into darkness, something you were touching on in the last segment there. And I think it's so wonderful and so necessary. And I think even these are the things we were touching on first time I was on your show, and we had the idea that the world that we live in is essentially a psychedelic world, or as how I was sort of positing it. And the idea that here we are, this idea of venturing into unknown territory, and I feel like the darkness to me represents the same thing as venturing into territory that's sort of unknown, or that you're maybe you're putting your guard down and stepping out into something. I think it's so important, and I'm glad that we're all doing this.
It's the unseen, the exposed. Well, when you go into a situation that you're unfamiliar with, when you're basically at the mercy, like let's say you walk into a predator's territory, for example, and you're not aware that there's a predator hiding behind these bushes or whatever, you're exposed. And I think that what this movement is doing is it's recognizing that the human race is currently in the territory of a predator and attempting to expose them instead.
Absolutely. It doesn't have to always, I mean, I understand what you meant by that, but it doesn't always have to be something predatory. It's the idea of something completely unknown. And I think we often, when we step out into the darkness, we're expecting predators. We're expecting that something's going to jump out of that alley if you live in a city or if you're out in, foresty area, then maybe something jumping out of the shrubs or the bushes. And in some cases, that's true. And you should be very aware that there are dangers and threats to your physical body. Absolutely. And in the same way, sometimes you'll find if you go into these spaces, you're not going to always only find predators, but you might find wonderful opportunities that you didn't expect.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. Some of the worst experiences that I've ever had have actually wound up to be some of the most beneficial. You know, it's ironic, isn't it?
I think it's that we're so afraid of what we don't know. We want to know everything. And yet it's absolutely vital that we not know, that we have spaces within us, spaces of unknown, so that we can bring in new information. We can mix things around. If there's no space, you can't move. If everything was matter, you couldn't move. So, I see the darkness as like the space within which we move and where we can explore. It's this lack of exploring that's really, really dangerous within this world, This lack of being able to question is really just a way of exploring something. You don't have to come up with something concrete at the end of it. You can just have an exploration, and it will change your world in some way.
Have you noticed people are hyperly afraid of consequences, even consequences that don't really even exist had they even investigated or, you know, allegedly put themselves at risk? I've had people message me and say, Vinny, how can you do this? So, you know, kind of talk on the radio and stuff like that. Aren't you afraid that you'll be assassinated or something? It's just like, well, mate, I'll tell you what, nobody's threatened me. Nobody's tried to kill me. Nobody's really sabotaged me or anything like that. I don't know what of these risks of which you speak. There's nothing to stop you from coming out and starting a radio show and helping give a platform to people who ordinarily don't get heard by the general public.
Well, you haven't been sabotaged yet.
Not yet. I can't wait till I do, though.
Alex and I came on this show today to do that to you.
Well, see, this will be a good learning experience for me, I think. And
how to navigate.
I prefer to... you see, Alan, you know, you kind of... You strip back things to a sort of a Stone Age understanding, which is kind of very, very concrete, which is ironic considering the complication of what synchronicity is and stuff like that. So it's kind of like making simple that which is complicated, and I think that's actually the job of teachers, essentially. You know, you're giving out the the Saturday morning cartoon version of the late night horror movie, as it were, kind of like the yabba dabba do of the Aberdessa Green.
Something like that, yeah. It's funny to me that the conversation went in this way. Is that as you probably know, the first time I was on your show, we spoke about, I put out a book called The Sync Book, which is why it's, of course, thesyncbook.com. It was the first volume. We just put out, at the end of 2012, we put out a second volume, which Alex Robinson contributed a chapter to, a really wonderful chapter. And this book has a subtitle, which is Shadow and Light. It's this idea of what you have to sort of venture into. And in this, the whole reason of doing not only the first sync book as 26 different authors, but then to even do a second volume with 26 completely new authors, is exactly for the reason Alex says, this idea of unknowing. I felt like if I were to do a book about this is Alan's take on synchronicity, that's only part of the answer, because I can only ever possibly understand so much because I'm going to understand it through the lens of Alan. This is how Alan perceives, you know, geopolitics. This is how Alan perceives synchronicity. This is how Alan perceives everything. So the only way I feel like to get really as close to the truth as we could get is to allow for all these different possibilities. There are people who I invited into this book who I really don't agree with their take on it. And that's totally okay, because I'm still learning something from it. I'm still seeing that this is another way to look at it. And I feel like if we get as many eyes on this puzzle, whether that be, again, geopolitics, synchronicity, anything in between, as many eyes as we can get on it and as many people we can have joining into the conversation, we open ourselves up to the possibility of getting much further than if we just, you know, bang our heads against the wall.
It's an exploration. That's exactly what it is. And that's that willingness to look from lots of different angles, because people do have amazing things to contribute. And sometimes, you know, often if I'm typing and I'll make a mistake, and often that mistake in the word is like, wow, I never thought of it. And I see it's a whole new way of looking at something. It's this introduction of things that are beyond the normal, beyond what we're used to. The introduction of randomness, which allows us to see whole new ways, whole new perspectives.
Well, this is another element that I believe is also very important to have in your life. Differences of opinion. Have you ever been to a mainstream political party meeting and you hear all these people talking? They're saying the exact same thing that the party leader's been saying for years and what have you. And you can understand these people have never had an original thought in their lives. And so naturally, the people who are completely uncreative are going to be the ones to create a creative solution to get us out of this terrible situation that they created through not creating anything properly. Does that make a lot of sense? Doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me. And the reason for this is these people are not prepared to entertain the possibility that they might be wrong. If you're not prepared to entertain the possibility that you might be wrong about something, then heck, you might be very wrong indeed and continue to be wrong until such a point as you fall on your ass. There's a guy who said, what was it? If you think you might be a cosmic schmuck, then you're probably not a cosmic schmuck because you're worried about it and you're thinking, what if I become a cosmic schmuck? But if you never think to yourself, you know what, maybe I'm being a bit of a cosmic schmuck, then you probably will be, you probably already are that schmuck and will continue to be so. And this is the part of the introspection. And what was that part of Zeitgeist that I was talking about? Yeah, being wrong should be seen as an opportunity. An opportunity to learn something you don't already know. An opportunity to expand and make something better. Being wrong is not often instead viewed as bad, as embarrassing, as something that should make you retreat further inwards and never speak out again. It's not the way it should happen, I don't think.
It's that fear of looking foolish again that we're also, you know, we've been trained to be so afraid of. We're terrified of looking foolish. And yet the fool is the first card in tarot. It's the beginning step. You're always going to look foolish when you start something. You can't help it.
How can people get into a society where being intelligent and admitting your faults and things of that nature, wearing your heart on your sleeve? Because I think we're all trying to put this armor around us, this artificial psychological armor. You know, I feel comfortable with this job, that relationship with my best friend, that relationship with my girlfriend, and that's basically the end of their understanding. You know, the structure of the universe, atomic catastrophes, or anything like this. Anything serious, anything mind bending, gets thrown out the window because it doesn't fit within the paradigm of my happy, otherwise easy-peasy life.
Well, you know, I think that's just it. Is everything that we're doing, obviously we're taking different angles from it, but what we're doing is we're chipping away at that armor around people, right? When you bring people this idea of a political paradigm in which everything they think they knew was wrong, they thought the police were there to protect them, and then they find out actually the police are there to help oppress them. You know, that the banking system isn't there to secure their money, but to steal their money, and et cetera, et cetera. I'm doing something similar, and I feel like Alex and I probably are handling similar territory, where we're chipping away at people's previously held expectations of what, you know, Alex says, what words mean, what these archetypes mean. And I'm doing something similar, where I'm trying to chip away at all the preconceived notions, and this certainly helps. To me, there's almost no difference in what we do. We're just helping to kind of chip away that armor and allow people to start to figure it out for themselves. You mentioned Zeitgeist. Like, I feel like what Zeitgeist did, where they lay out all the different archetypes and how this is a sort of repetitious story. They say, oh, we're going to show you a picture of a Bible and tell you that this Jesus story is actually a copied story and isn't original. Well, that's incredibly helpful information. And then they just say, well, that's proof that it's kind of not true, and then we shove it all to the side. My thing is, no, it's evidence, or this is great data. Now, what do we want to do with that data? Don't push it to the side. So again, while I might disagree with the next step in that process, I think Zeitgeist was amazing to help break down people's preconceived notions of what they thought they knew or how things actually are.
That's the most dangerous occupation in the world, isn't it? Helping to break down society so that it can be rebuilt into something better.
Sure, and then you have people, you know, this is where we get into that Illuminati idea of, you know, order out of chaos and all this sort of stuff. So there are people who are organizations who throw the phrase around, and they might be hoping to break it down to rebuild it in their image. I think the difference is what we're doing is hoping to break it down so people can find their own image. And there's a huge difference, but it often gets confused.
Well, that reminds me of the story of George Washington, how a number of the other participants in the Revolution approached him after winning the war, and instead of making him president, they wished to make him king. For which he allegedly got very furious with them and said, look, we just overthrew a king who was suppressing all our rights. How dare you want to make me king? This is not the society that we wanted. This is not what we just fought and bled and died for. Okay? I'm going to be the president, and I'm going to do it in a Masonic garb on a black and white floor. You gotta love history. You can't make this stuff up. We'll be right back after the break. At the Vinnie Eastwood Show, ladies and gentlemen, I would like you to visit the homepage of thevinnieeastwoodshow.com. We post the day's archives there fairly regularly. And also, if you want to donate or subscribe, we will give you access to commercial-free archives of the show, which are very enjoyable to listen to. Indeed. We'll see you right after the break. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. My very special guests are Alan Abadesa Green and Alex Robinson. Websites are thesyncbook.com, that's sync with a Y, and also toolonginthisplace.wordpress.com is Alex's contributions. And also, Alan, I wanted to inquire, because this is something you were saying over the break here, is that you've done The Sync Book 2, with a whole raft of new authors, and I think that really kind of embodies the spirit of exploration and really getting a whole feel and of different perspectives around the world when you get on people, even those that you don't really agree with.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And, like, I'm trying not to obviously focus on that, you know, but my thing is it's important for me to see, is there something I've missed? Can you know, it's almost like allowing someone to give that argument, not just because maybe you'll convince me differently, but maybe that answer is right for someone else. Like, I'm a firm believer in that there isn't a one-size-fits-all answer or philosophy or anything for humanity. You know, we are individuals. We're individuals for a reason. And even though, obviously, the study of synchronicity takes you into subjects of, like, collective consciousness and things like that, I'm still very much a believer in individuality, and that we can explore this collective consciousness, but then we always bring it back to our individual consciousness, and that's how we process it and maybe apply it differently. So, yeah, that sort of thing where it's like, all right, that, you know, this one person's perspective might not really speak to me. But again, two things. I might actually learn something from it. I might be convinced differently. Or maybe there's someone else out there who that is the right answer for. That's the information they're needing to hear at this moment. So, absolutely. I feel like this is, and it's the only way to really feel honest about these sorts of things is to say, I don't know. I don't know. And even though I think I disagree with that guy, well, maybe he's right. So, you know, it needs fair space on the table.
Yes, my three favorite words, Alan. I don't know. My three most hated words are, I don't care.
Yeah.
Yeah. What's the point of being alive if you don't care?
So, it's interesting. You know, this whole process of doing these books has been just a really fascinating exploration for me. And it's been, again, bouncing back and forth on things to say, I think I know enough that I feel comfortable coming out and trying to speak to people about it and introducing a topic, but also at the same time remaining hopefully humble enough to say, but I don't know all the answers, and this is not something I could have done by myself. I need 52 other people to offer something else that I can't offer. You know, to give their perspectives, to give their information that maybe I haven't researched that angle or things like that. I tried doing James Corbett's show. He asked me something about, I used the phrase like quantum entanglement. And he was like, do you really mean that? And I was like, yeah, I mean that. And he's like, well, he's like, that's not scientifically accurate. I'm like, I'm an artist. I probably shouldn't be speaking of quantum physics, but we have Anthony Peake in the book. We have Dr. Kirby Surprise in the book, who I think they know what they're talking about. And it's hard for me maybe to try and bring their information out in a few minute segment on a radio show. But at the same time, this is why I need someone else who knows the science behind it. I need someone else who, you know, takes a different perspective, someone who comes at it from the conspiracy angle, someone who comes at it from the new age angle. All these different things I feel like are really important, so you make sure that nothing gets missed. If you don't, you know, uncover every stone, you're bound to miss something. And these are people, everyone kind of bring their strengths to it.
Yeah. I see it very similar to be a scientific research, as kind of similar to Transformers in a way. There's this giant transformer called Devastator, who's comprised of about like six or seven who all join together. You know, four of them become a leg or an arm, and one becomes a head, and one becomes the body, and so on and so forth. Without it, all you've got is smaller, insignificant things that can't really make a difference. But all combined together, you have this this almighty machine that is capable of conquering and destroying and what have you. And I think this is similar in terms of research projects and things of that nature. People all bring their different elements, and without all those different elements, you don't have a complete machine.
And this is why I, you know, like there's this, we get into some tricky territory. We, you know, there are people who say like, oh, collectivism is bad. Well, that's probably true. You know, this idea of a one world government. I don't support a one world I don't support any government. I'm an anarchist. I don't want a local government, let alone a one world government. But this idea that we are one world, I do think we should support that idea, that I can speak to you guys who are both in New Zealand, and we can share information across national boundaries and geographic boundaries. I think that's something very much that we should appreciate. This idea that collectivism, if it means coming together and pooling our resources and our information that we can compare notes and yet still leave room for disagreements and all that sort of stuff, that's great. Collectivism where it's some sort of, you know, brain dead hive mind that everyone's chanting the same, you know, five words over and over, or no one's allowed to think differently. No, of course I don't support that. So like, we get some tricky territories, but it's to say that, you know, these things are really important. I think people coming together is hugely, hugely important, and particularly whether it be across country lines and ideological lines as well.
Yeah, it works on the small scale, I think. Like a band, for example, you know, somebody's doing the drums, somebody's two people are doing guitars, and one person's lead singer or something like that. Is that collectivism or is that teamwork? And what's the difference? Where do you draw the line?
That's a damn good question. I don't know. Wait, Brett, where do you draw the line? I think if it's someone says, if the guitar player says to the, you know, the drummer, hey, you have to play my song, or I mean, I don't, you know, that's why bands always get into fights, right?
So. Well, that's what we have emotions for.
What's that?
That's what we have our emotions for, you know, that's what they're supposed to be telling us. It feels good. So, you know, it feels good, then it's probably going to be good. And if it doesn't feel good, a lot of the time, too, our emotions are so twisted and mixed up. We don't really know what we feel. And a lot of the time, now we're not even allowed to feel. There's so many things we're not allowed to feel, which means there's so many emotions we're not able to get in touch with. You know, what's his name? Antonio Damasio has just pointed out the importance of emotion in survival. It is so significant in human survival, and yet in so many ways, we can't use our emotion. You're not allowed to have this emotion. You're not allowed to show that. You have to keep your, you know, straight face, keep a smile on. So we're not actually able to access the emotions we need that will tell us whether something is good for us or not good for us, whether it's working. You know, we live in such a restricted, armored way. This armor that people have around themselves so much, I think, is armoring against emotion, against feeling.
I think it's more like an Iron Maiden, where you think you're surrounded by armor, but you've actually get punctured by all the spikes that you've created for yourself.
Well said.
Yeah. But either way, it's not a full, you're not having forward momentum. You are killing yourself slowly.
Why is that? Are we all suckers for punishment here, do you think, Alex?
I would come back to that this is a trauma-based society, and we really need to understand that on every level it's trauma-based. And we have to be kind to ourselves and understand that this is what we're coming from. We're not coming from a healthy background or a healthy ancestry. We are coming upon layer of trauma that's just building and building. And I think part of the reasons why we have World War I and World War II, that it could happen, that World War II could possibly happen after World War I. You know, that people didn't say no, it points to this massive, the trauma-based mind control is the Western world. It's not individual people. It's not, you know, little actors in Hollywood or something. It's the entire Western culture. And we're not having access to our emotions. Part of just, if you can feel emotion, it can start to break down. It's like food. It's like we can't digest. We can't digest. We've got all this undigested stuff inside of us. If you can't digest your food, you're going to be very sick. You're going to starve. We're not digesting emotion. We're not having access to it. We don't even know which emotion is which. And emotion is the very crux of our survival. There was that Candace Pert, who believed that emotion is the link between matter and spirit, the spiritual world and matter. It's emotion.
Alex, man, your point is incredibly well taken. I do get exactly what you're saying, and I think I agree with you for the most part. But can I ask, is there a fine line between understanding that we all our emotions and everything in our culture is based on trauma, but without falling into a victim mentality?
Oh, we don't need to fall into a victim mentality at all. This is my research, my study, and using myself as well to say that you can be very strong, you know? It's looking clearly at reality. This is the one thing. Most of the truth movement does not look at reality. They look at what they want to see. I'm saying we need to look at reality, and the reality, as clear as I can get, the proto-truth that I'm working on at the moment, is that the West is very much trauma-based mind control, that we come from, we are living within this trauma society. And so we need to just take the blinkers off and look and say, wow, yeah, you know, instead of going, oh, look at these people, they won't wake up, we're all part of this. We're looking a bit more, we're looking at reality a bit more. But we can't possibly think that we know it, that we've got it, that we can see. You know, when I, again, use my own life, I am my own lab rat. So it's just a constant looking back and looking at what's reality here. What am I not wanting to face? What am I afraid of? You know, and just turning and going back into that thing, because I need to see reality so that I can deal with it. So that I can change the world.
This reminds me of something my producer was telling me just before he left New Zealand. He said that, you know, I believe that there's a whole bunch of people out there who will just never wake up, you know, like it's too late, it's all decided, you know, it's predestined. And I said to him, did you at some point wake up, or were you always awake? And he's like, no, I wasn't always awake. I woke up in 1997. And I say, well, okay, what's the cutoff date here, you know? Is it only past 1997 that people could wake up? Is it only, you know? It's not based on reality, bro. You know, you're not feeling happy because these particular situations and the government screwing you over and whatever, but that's not anything to do with reality, okay? That's just something that's happening to you, and you're taking what's applying to you and then trying to apply it and make it stick to everybody else so that you can have some kind of certainty, some kind of comfort with things being bad, because at least I know for a fact that they are, when it wasn't a fact at all, and you're just doing it to make yourself feel comfortable. And we do this all the time, always ragging on everybody else because, hey, they haven't gotten as far as I have. Like, have you ever seen, like, somebody who's a wealthy, rich businessman or something like that, he's always giving everybody else hell and telling them to get off their ass and that kind of thing, and so they can be more like me. I don't think anybody should be like anybody else. Why can't we all just figure things out for ourselves and stop being comfortable with being with being unhappy with ourselves and unhappy with the world and unhappy with everybody else? It's so ironic. In order to be comfortable, we have to make ourselves feel happy with discomforting things.
That's right. That's liking. That is liking things that we dislike. So we are lying to ourselves constantly. We are not accepting, I dislike this thing. This is wrong for me. So many people, you think, how many people go to work every week on a Monday? They loathe their job. They force themselves to like it in some way. You know, they feel like, what happens if they are honest? You know, what happens? Because you're going to have to take some big steps. If you are honest, you really are going to have to take some big steps. It's just how it is. You know, the amount of people who are dying slowly through the work that they do. If you see it, if you acknowledge it, you have to take some big steps. You know, you have to face, and it hurts, but it's important.
I have a physical example of this. Here in New Zealand, we have a safety course called SightSafe, and it's just basically like 100 questions. You know, they mark you 1 out of 100, and you have to get above 90 in order to pass the course and get your little SightSafe pass card, right? Before that, New Zealand in the Western world had the highest percentage of deaths and accidents on work sites, building and construction and so forth, because we had a mentality that was consistent of three words: she'll be right. You know, and the government was looking at this and going, oh my God, we've got 20,000 injuries last year and we're only a country of about 3 million people on major work sites. This is really dangerous. We have to implement something. And they went from 20,000 injuries and I think quite a lot of deaths as well, hundreds of, if not 1,000 or so, to virtually nothing inside of 6 months of introducing these new safety protocols, which are very simple things. And I believe that that's right, exactly what we're talking about here, is if you simply identify just these tiny little things that might be a little bit dangerous, you know, perhaps a sparking wire, perhaps you're not properly secured or fastened to a ladder or whatever, it might be a bit dangerous and you might want to take a little bit of extra care. But people have been encouraged to not care. We'll be right back.
Rappers, but I've never been edible. I'm a cracker, not a vegetable, fed to an extraterrestrial. The beat is so electrical, it'll pump your heart ventricles, but I bet you will eject it if I start getting intellectual.
Welcome back.
So until I can say I'm
welcome, ladies and gentlemen, it's the final segment here with the illustrious Ellen Ebadesic Green and the miraculous Alex Robinson. Their websites are thesyncbook.com. That's sync with a Y. It's not about the Titanic, and also Alex Robinson as well, too long in this place, .wordpress.com. So I was wondering, seeing as we are really now running down the clock, what is it to talk about? What is there to talk about?
I would like to take a moment to thank Alex and all the others. I kind of spoke about how I felt it was important to bring everybody's viewpoints together, but I want to thank them particularly. Alex, it's a pleasure always to speak to you. But the idea that bringing these people together, when I asked, it was very much an invitation to play, which I know you guys were talking about the importance of adult creativity and adult playing in a non, you know, necessarily sexual or things like that. What you guys were talking about in the first hour of how do adults play and how do we play together? Well, this sync book to me was very much an invitation for that of, hey, here's some people whose work I enjoy. Can we all play together? And I want to thank Alex for agreeing to do so. I want to thank everyone else we have. I know who you've also had in your show. You had Neil Kramer on. He's in the first volume of the Sync Book. Anthony Peake is in the second Sync Book. Frater X, a fellow American Freedom Radio host, is in the second volume of the Sync Book. And a bunch of others. You had Mark LeClair and Violator Hellspawn and things like that. So I just, these are some of the authors that you should be familiar with. I want to not only thank
Ellen, hold on a second.
Ask your listeners if they would be so kind, go to
thesyncbook.com. And have a look and maybe purchase a book there. Ellen, we're having some real trouble coming out with your audio there. You might want to just click off your webcam, see if that solves the problem. Okay, Ellen, are you still there?
I'm still here. Can you hear me?
That's better.
Does it sound any better? Yeah? I just want to ask everyone who's listening, please go to thesyncbook.com. It's S-Y-N-C. It's thesyncbook.com. And please click on the author tab, because you're going to see all 52 authors, and you can, that's a portal, so you can go to their websites, their blogs, things like that, and get a chance to really get exposed to some of their research. Of course, you can please invite you and ask you to buy a copy of the Sync book and other books that we've put out. We have a radio, we have two radio shows each week. Alex is going to actually be on one of our radio shows at the end of May, called 42 Minutes. So there's a whole bunch of stuff there, but I would really ask everyone to click on the authors tab and dive into some of their research and their websites.
Okay. And that'll give you something to read about, if not something to talk about, assuredly. Alex.
Mm-hmm.
Is there anything you've ever really wanted to talk about but you thought, maybe it's not the right time, doesn't come up in the conversation, or maybe people think I'm a bit nuts for saying this?
Oh, absolutely.
Shoot. Gotcha.
But, you know, but this does fit in with everything that where I'm... If there's not a framework for people to hear you, they won't hear you. And not only that, they will get their backs up. They will shut down. They will move out. They will attack you. This is facing reality. Reality is that you cannot force someone to hear you. And in all my work, in the podcasts I've done, why we work so well is that it's as if we take off all our armor, we put down all our swords, and we come together and we have an exploration where there is no enmity, no attacks. What happens is that people speak a lot slower. You know, it's a bit like the nighttime. And amazing things are said, amazing things happen. But that's because there are people wanting to explore something, looking to understand something. You try and reach people whose ears are closed, whose minds are closed. You may as well take your head and smash it into a brick wall. And I've just learned that that's not a good idea. And, you know, it hurts. It doesn't hurt them. It only hurts me.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. Preach to the converted, ladies and gentlemen. It's a hell of a lot easier.
But that doesn't mean that you don't, you're not, you know, like the animals, that, like a bird that builds its nest, it's one twig here and one twig here, it goes collecting. So we use these little things and we keep building. You know, I will not stop. There's nothing's going to stop me. But I do it in my own way. And I use synchronicity very much in my life. But I don't, as I wrote in the Sync book, I don't bow down to it. I make it work for me. I insist that it makes sense to me. And if it doesn't make sense to me, I ignore it.
Mm.
And, you know, there are tools that we need. There are tools that we can use that we haven't used. So intuition and synchronicity, these are tools to be used. We have to practice with them.
I view ideas as a product and human consciousness as the marketplace. And if you are experienced in sales, you do know that you cannot force anybody to buy your product, right? So you don't try and force anybody. But you do know that there's many people who are on the fence who, with a little bit of persuasion, will jump the fence and come onto your side, right? That's actually what we've really got to be focused on here, I think, is not focusing to give these products, i.e. the truth or just ideas or whatever, to people who will be absolutely unwilling, no matter what, to come on board. It's a waste of freaking time. And you're absolutely right. It does make you incredibly frustrated and angry. You know, I was walking down the street one day and somebody from, what was that cultist organization? Greenpeace, yeah. And they said, oh, you want to sign on to carbon tax everybody? I was like, nah, bro, I'm not keen, eh? And as I was walking away, he goes, yeah, you don't care about the planet or anybody in it, do you? It's just... That's going to really make me want to sign on, isn't it, bro?
Well, there's a topic I could bring up, which is along those lines, which is cancer, which I've written about. Cancer is a new religion. We have the religion of cancer. People bow down to it. I mean, I've seen Sky Tower lit up in pink advertising it. We have months of awareness towards breast cancer or prostate cancer. And if someone's got cancer, it's like they've become a sacred person, you know, and you treat them so carefully. And I had a joke once about, you know, with breast cancer, like one lump or two, you know, like they used to do with the, you know, what you want in your tea for sugar. But because it's become, you can't question it. You can't. And if you don't go and get your irradiated mammograms and things like that, oh, there's something really wrong with you. And we have a world that bows down to cancer. And you can't say anything. And if you don't give money, or like it's like you said there, you know, my God, you're so uncaring. And there is no, what about the concept of health? You know, what about bowing down to health? But no, we've got this. And if you look, and that's, I don't know whether someone on your show would be great, would be Dr. Toni Jeffries, who wrote The Cancer Conspiracy. She's a New Zealander as well, New Zealand doctor.
You got her contact details for me after the show?
I'll find out what I can, yeah. She's written a book, and excellent book. And but, I mean, anyone who's using their mind, who's just thinking a little bit, will go, well, this is really bizarre. Look how much attention there is on cancer, you know. If you have a mammogram, women are six times more likely to get breast cancer because you're irradiating breast tissue, you're crushing it as well. But it's business. Cancer must be one of the biggest businesses in the world out there today. What a money-making business, you know. And where is the sense that goes, well, this seems a bit wrong. Look at all the focus on this. The whole breast cancer issue, that's not the biggest killer of women. But so why is that pushed? Because you have a massive, the business behind it, you know, all the mammograms. Who pays for all that, you know? Once you're 40, every year, free ones in New Zealand, push, 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 push. It's a business. And where's people's common sense about this?
Well, apparently, cancer can survive forever as long as it didn't kill the host. You know that?
Is that right?
It's a perpetual growing virus. And if you put it out into space and give it the conditions it needs, hey, you can get a cancer the size of a planet. allegedly. And I'm thinking about this as well. How big does the industry have to get before you think to yourself, you know what, this is a really bad, dangerous tumour, this entire cancer industry. Maybe we need a bit of surgery.
Well, apparently the only acceptable treatments for cancer, you know, all your sort of radioactive stuff, if there's a spillage in the hospital, they have to put on, like, special protective coats to clean it up, and yet they're putting this straight into people's bodies. You know, where is this?
There was a lady in Brooklyn or something who had the liquid iodine cancer treatment or whatever, chemotherapy, and she set off a radiation alarm just before she got on a Greyhound bus.
Yeah. That just gives you an idea of the toxicity. But I don't, the toxicity of the Western world, I believe it comes from, it's trauma-based. We couldn't or wouldn't allow these sort of things to happen if we weren't all ourselves rooted in trauma. You know, people who have been traumatized can allow all sorts of things to happen. If you're a healthy individual where your mind works well, you're free to question, this couldn't exist. It just couldn't exist.
Well, unfortunately, just like most cancer patients around the world who still believe in chemotherapy is a good thing, we've run out of time. Alan, thank you very much for coming on the show with us today, and Alex as well. And ladies and gentlemen, if you do want to look into the cancer epidemics or the therapies, okay, vaccines got cancer viruses in them, okay? There's a book called Dr. Mary's Monkey where they actually engineered all these things, and everybody who gets vaccinated basically gets cancer. There's one thing to look at. And the other things to look at is the effects of high-dose intravenous vitamin C as a cancer cure. Extremely cheap, extremely effective, 70 years of backed-up frickin' scientific research to get it on there, if you can find it, and get a doctor who's brazen enough to use it. And the other is the Rick Simpson method, where you use high potency THC cannabis oil to cure and get that stuff to drop off you. Thank you very much for listening, ladies and gentlemen, and we'll see you again sometime.